Good day. You're listening to European Buddha.
Good morning and welcome to the European Buddha podcast. Today's topic is again one of the basic truths about life and eventually will happen to all of us. The encounter of death and the process of dying. Yeah, normally we don't talk about these things very much in our daily life, and often we feel it's some kind of error or mistake when death is showing its face. We want to find out why that's the case and how we can approach this experience. Well, with this being said, welcome to today's episode. And hello, Emilia. Would you like to introduce our guest?
I'm delighted to introduce our guest, Kirsten De Leeuw, who is connecting with us from the west coast of Ireland this morning. In that same place, she also teaches in the Chongcheng Beara Buddhist Meditation Center. Kirsten is a meditation teacher, author, and trainer in the field of contemplative care offering. In her first book, Present Through the End, A Caring Companion's Guide for Accompanying the Dying, Kirsten shares her decades of experience supporting terminally ill patients and their families and teaching caregivers. Kirsten is also the host of Authentic Presence podcast. This podcast explores the deeper questions of human experience and caregiving. Kirsten will be a guest speaker in the Becoming EBU seminar on death and dying. So warmly welcome, Kirsten. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Amelia, for your warm welcome.
Can you recall your first encountering with death?
I had a great grandmother, and she died when I was 14. So it was a very challenging, tender age to be confronted with death and dying. And she was the one person I really loved so much. And I had her for 14 years, and she was a great model for me because she was 11 years trapped in a nursing home in her bed, couldn't leave the room, and it was a sub-basement where you only could see half of the sky if you were lucky, and the rest were just cars, the tires of the cars. To this day, I'm just amazed. She was very content with her life and very present. So when she died, it was really, really sad. And my grandmother told me, her daughter, and before she died, the days leading or weeks leading up to it, death, has a certain smell, the environment changes, and I could see something shifting and changing. And I remember during that time, she asked me to touch her, and I was repulsed, I didn't, because it was, you could see her veins pulsing through a really almost translucent skin, and I was scared. I was really scared. But she was still kind of radiating warmth and love from her. She didn't take it personally. Well, she knew I was a teenager. I was kind of really confused. So I was still held in this warmth. So when she died, I really had a lot of regrets that I wasn't able to. And then when my grandmother told me, I was staying with my grandparents at the time, that she had died that morning, my grandmother was very wise. She said, we are going now to sit with her body. You don't have to. If you don't like to come in, don't worry, So I decided to go, but to sit outside because I was afraid what I would see. So I wasn't quite ready to see her body. And in hindsight, now after doing this work for so many years, I was really grateful to my grandmother that she gave me the option out. But in a loving way, I know you loved your great-grandmother, but it's really up to you. There's no pressure.
Where did she go? Did you had back then an idea of that?
Good question, Martin. I didn't. I really didn't. I thought she was, because I always felt she's still around. The body was dissolving, or physically she wasn't present anymore, but her love was still there. And I always had a strong faith and a faith that it's okay. At the time I wasn't a Buddhist practitioner. No, I was raised Christian. So I still had the sense, you would maybe call it higher power at the time, or God, that she kind of, that's, she's with him, or not even with him, not even as a person. And I didn't visualize God as a person, but as this loving energy. So I think maybe something like that. But I never actively at that age asked myself. It was more like, what is death? What is it? What happens there?
Buddha taught not to be afraid of death. What makes death so scary and even creepy?
I would say maybe scary first, you know, creepy, then we already have a concept, you know, we have a story already, we have a narrative, you know, if it's creepy, but it's scary. And also from my own personal experience, it's scary because it's so unfamiliar. You know, we're so in our society, it's not visible. So I would think most of, if you're listening right now, which is, you know, where do people die? Where do our, you know, loved ones, friends, you know, parents, grandparents? They're mostly in institutions most of the time. Dying at home is most of everybody's wish, but it doesn't happen so much. So death is not visible. We don't experience it. If I wouldn't, you know, if my grandmother wouldn't have said, you know, you just come along, I would never have been exposed to it or through my hospice work. So it's invisible, but happens behind closed doors. And then you stand in front of a coffin, but you don't know what happened, you know. It's also, it's been medicalized. It has become a medical event. Dying at home, it's so important because this is, if you look back 100 years ago, 200 years ago, most of us would have died at home. And it would have been a common occurrence and not strange and foreign and scary. And the way we see death is probably through TV. I read an article that, you know, as if you grow up right now, you see thousands and thousands of deaths on TV or social media. You're exposed to it. But honestly, in one way, it's on a very superficial level. It's not actually the actual encounter with death and what it means to our lives and what's happening, and to see it's a natural process. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, you know, dying is like changing clothes. So it's a transition. It's a normal occurrence. And we see it in nature that everything changes and shifts. The season is changing all the time. Things around us are changing and we are changing with it. So it's natural. And the thing is, even after all these years at the bedside, I still have great respect, you know, to be honest, because death also being with dying is always you are with your own dying. And it's very humbling.
Yeah, there's also what I find, death is also good news because it is really telling something true. Like in this age of fake news, this is very, it's, yeah. You can't avoid that. You can try. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I also have sometimes this impression, you will die someday. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. I'm really feeling, I have fear, but I also feel very human. And it's a almost tickling experience. And I feel alive. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, in a sense, I can also see why death is sometimes good news. It makes things very clear.
Life becomes alive in the face of death, which is such a koan, you know, such a paradox, isn't it? I feel that too when I'm in the presence of somebody, you know, and we're all dying, we just, you know, ignore it. But when we know, or when I'm around somebody where it's really clear, As you said, or when I think about that, everything becomes heightened, clear. And also there's a sense of deep gratitude and love, you know, and also tenderness, you know. We don't know when we see the person again, you know. I might get into the car and something happens. I finish this phone call and something happens to either one of us, you know. So there's a vulnerability and tenderness and also a sharp acuteness, you know, kind of a sharpness of that realization. So I've learned over the years with that topic, death and dying, just don't put things off. we always assume later happens. So it's like really not to procrastinate and have these conversations we need to have or now and express our love or say the things and also even say the difficult things, you know, things we need to work through now and not wait. We just, yeah. And it's the way you describe it, Martin, with a tickling and there's aliveness, there is tremendous, there can be even a sense of joy. And that's such, again, a paradox, even for the dying person. I've seen it. There can be surges of joy when they're accepted the fact that they're dying and they're around in an environment. Yes, where they can relax, where they can be open, feel safe and loved, you know. There can be tremendous joy and of having lived a full life or this moment and this connection, you know, and feeling it to the fullest. And even the difficult things, you know. I'm still alive. Wow, how amazing is that, you know?
Kirsten, how did you end up in this field and what you're doing at the moment?
You know, there's never a straight path. And I just one step at a time, I would never have imagined it. Looking back now, it's like, oh, yeah. So I started, I grew up in Germany. And I started in the early 90s getting interested. I kind of started on my own Buddhist path and I got interested. I read the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, which just had come out and it really had a big impact on me. And it just validated some of my experiences in such a deep and profound way. And I thought, I want to go further. And at the time I was, you know, I was time still studying and then later working as a TV and radio journalist. But I knew there was something else I was supposed to do. So I started a hospice volunteer work. I started training. And at the time in Germany, it was still very clinical and technical. And it took a year of training to actually be with somebody, you know, so which heightened the anxiety and the fear around it, you know. And then I was looking for bringing my Buddhist practice together with the path of caring for the dying. So I heard about the Zen Hospice in San Francisco, which was at the time one of the first Buddhist hospices in the West. So in my naivety, I just called them up and said, you know, could I just come and do a practicum, an internship? And they interviewed me and said, yes, you will be the first one. We never had that before, but why not? So I spent the summer there and I fell in love. I really fell in love with the work and being there and the way I was taught by the staff and also by the nursing staff, by all the aides and how to be there. And that opened a whole new world and I realized this is what I like and want to do. Sometimes this work is called calling, and it was really a calling. So I decided to stay, and I worked there for a number of years. And then I started teaching other caregivers. So it just kept evolving. It's still evolving, you know. Who knows where this path will take me, but it's evolving.
You mentioned this book, the Tibetan Book of Death. What would you say is its message?
So there is a Tibetan Book of the Dead. That's the classical, I know, and by Padmasambhava or Guru Rinpoche. You would call him the founder of Tibetan Buddhism. He brought Buddhism from India to Tibet. And what I was referring to was is the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, which is inspired by the Tibetan Book of the Dead, but it has also the vision around life. So it's a kind of, it really walks you through the entire path of life from, you know, meditation teachings to the whole spiritual path to the moment of death and after in a very profound way. It's basically, if you like, a translation, a modern translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, but including life as well, how to live well, you know, to live well and die.
And do you find it applicable in your work?
Absolutely, absolutely. I go back to it again and again. It has a beautiful chapter on caring for the dying, hard advice for caring for the dying. And in just a few pages, you have the essence, really have the essence of what you need, and also how you can prepare yourself. And it's very accessible. I remember when I first read it, I only could read, kind of read it to the middle of the book, because the rest is very kind of, then you go into more esoteric teachings of Tibetan Buddhism, what happens after death. And that was at that time foreign to me. And I said, well, I can give it a benefit of a doubt, because who knows what happens afterwards, you know? And so I just, yeah, but then through my work, I could even sense and feel there is something after death. There is something that continues. And it then makes made more and more sense that there is a spiritual essence that continues. So death is not the end of it, you know. It's again another chapter, and there's something that continues, and there's you can sometimes feel that, and sometimes people who are dying share their experience. And sounds maybe a bit ooh. But you know, there, if you're really quiet, you can sometimes sense there's something. Another dimension of our being, beyond the material, beyond our body, beyond what we can see, feel, or touch.
As I was reading your book, I was deeply touched by the story of John, your dear friend, and his message and request as he was facing death. The message was, just be my friend. In this kind of situations, how to be more caring? And the follow-up, how come is it so difficult to be caring towards ourselves?
Yeah, so my friend John, he died of AIDS in San Francisco. He was one of the longest survivors of AIDS, and it was a very, very difficult death. One of the most difficult deaths I've witnessed. And he released himself, and all his friends, his sangha, his Buddhist community, we gathered around him, and that afternoon I just sat at his bedside and asked him, yeah, what do you need? And he just looked at me with such a sad gaze, but there was so much tenderness and vulnerability, and said, just be my friend, you know. And that, as you said, that was so, it had such an impact to see the end of the day. It doesn't matter how much I know, how much experience I bring, or expertise, or even professional training. At the end of the day, it's one human to another. There's nothing extraordinary around being with a dying person. You do what you need to do, and you're present. And sometimes you screw up and it gets messy, you know, and you make a mistake and you said the wrong thing, or the person gets upset, or, you know, when they're moody, you get moody, or, you know, it's just normal. It's just really normal. So not just to, sometimes you think it has to be this super spiritual, like, deep experience in the glowing light. And yeah, it can be all of that, but also in the ordinariness of it. And so really, John taught me that, how important it is to just to show up as a friend and at the end of the day, and to be with the person. And sometimes it's also, I've learned, sometimes I don't know what to say or do. I just sit there and just to be honest. I think that's also death and dying, such a naked experience. It really challenges us to fully show up and to be honest, and also self-revealing, you know, because they have no place to hide anymore. So if I come in, death actually doesn't happen. It always happens to the other person. You know, that's kind of illusion where we feel safe. You know, the illusion, I won't die. Martin, as you said earlier, you know, this illusion, I'm permanent. And oh yes, dying happens to you, and you happen to know you're dying. But at the end of it, of the day, we're both in the same boat. It will happen to me as well. So it's a really a mirror, confrontative mirror. So you really need a lot of kindness and caring for yourself, as you said, you know, in that work, because you will see, in meditation practice, things do come up, right? You get to know your busy mind, you get to know all your edges and your restlessness and your judgmental mind and your critical voice, or everything rises. And it's quite similar to being with somebody. You actually keep looking at your own mind when you're in the presence of somebody who is facing a loss or that is dying. So it's in that way, it's similar to meditation practice. So it's really learning to hold whatever comes up, whatever our crazy monkey mind produces, to hold it with great kindness and tenderness, a great sense of humor, not to take it for real and serious and say, well, it's just what passes through my mind, but it's not who I am. So that's kind of the caring aspect. It's very important, self-forgiving.
This loving presence is very essential in your teachings. It's very beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And it's not a sign of weakness. Actually, to be tenderness is actually based on fearlessness, of really being, and it doesn't mean there is no fear. Also, we confuse that, you know. We think, oh, when I'm fearless, there is strength. But actually being open and vulnerable, the very thing we train in our meditation practice or mindfulness practice, to stay open and raw to all our experience, is the same thing. It's very, whenever we sit down on a meditation cushion, we can take it as a training path to prepare for own dying and to prepare for, yeah, the situation in the future when we know we have to let go of somebody we love dearly.
There's also a very nice quote from your book in the section about the power of loving kindness or loving presence. It says, when people experience deep suffering, what helps them most of all, more than anything we can say or do, is how we are. And I was thinking, well, this also applies to maybe to life. Sometimes it's not that important what I do, it's important how I do it. So It's interesting that in this section I was also remembered about how I conduct my life.
So but can you say a bit more? What did you find?
I know this question, what should I do? And it's endless. But the question of how I do things, it's really, I was just thinking how I drink my tea in the morning. It's really about my attitude towards myself, how I feel about myself, about life. And in Zen, this is a very nice also practice to serve tea, to offer tea, to drink tea, and do that. It's enough. So yeah, like that.
Yeah. Oh, that's enough. Exactly. That's so, it's so simple at the same time, so profound, isn't it? Yeah. Because when somebody is dying and they're approaching death, their entire life kind of slows down, and also their perception, the way we are, it really has a tremendous impact. Let's say if I come into a room, I'm very speedy, you know, I'm just very busy, I want to have my agenda, I want to push through, or, you know, or I'm not distracted, you know, I come in with my ordinary mind. That can have a very detrimental, negative impact on the person, because they're in a very different space. And then it kind of clashes. It's really also how I am doing what I'm doing. When I touch a person, am I actually do it with awareness and mindfulness, being fully there, you know, or do it in a distracted way? Whenever we do something in a distracted way, it can appear to the other person as aggression, or, you know, you're actually not really there. I remember when, and these are more personal stories, but I remember when my mother was dying, and that was a really painful experience for the entire family. And she, for a few months, she was in a teaching hospital, and it was a very clinical research environment. And so, I mean, they did the best they could, the care team, but you could see they were just then there, were moving her body or washing her or repositioning her in her bed. They just did it as a technical task, and something they have to do. And I could sense, and she sensed, that they were not comfortable with that, dealing with a terminal ill patient they cannot help anymore. And that's, as she said, that was one of the most painful experiences for her. She said, they don't see me. They just don't see me anymore. I could also then also see the pain of the people who were in that situation of not knowing how else they could be.
If one feels truly down, do you have a practice you could share with us on this challenging times?
Yeah. I think especially now with being in a pandemic, isn't it? It's even more important to find ways to uplift our spirits, you know? And in the Buddhist tradition, we have different practices, and I will mention them, but I want to maybe start out with like a warning label that we don't do the practice in order to avoid something. Yeah, so we don't use it as, this is uncomfortable, so I use this as a remedy, you know? That doesn't work. That's just a short time, you know, solution. And long term, we still have to deal with it. So just to be aware of our own attitude, how we practice and why we practice. A beautiful practice is, and a very accessible practice is loving kindness practice that was taught by the Buddha. He taught the practice as an antidote to fear, which is very beautiful, to fear and also anxiety. We experience so much, you know, and so you just keep saying to yourself, silently repeating to yourself, may I be happy, may I be well, may I live at ease, may I be safe. And you also can adapt these wishes to make it real for you. So there is not like, it's not like positive thinking. I'm well, I'm happy, you know, I'm safe. It's more like this aspiration. There is a gentleness to it, but also great clarity in may I be well, you know, and knowing this wellness is actually in me. That's what the good news is around the Buddha taught. There is Buddha nature, you know, there's this fundamental well-being, wholeness and goodness in each and every one of us. So this is something, and this loving kindness is a method of bringing that out. So it's not about there's anything lacking, but to bring out what's actually who we are. So it's a radical shift in focus. So sometimes if you just feel down or feel anxious or worried, to change what we're telling ourselves. So we can just change the track, change it to may I be happy, may I be well. Sometimes it's hard to believe that, and sometimes we have to fake it until we make it. So it's really just to keep working with the practice. Another practice is also just calling out for help, which traditionally would call it refuge. And we take refuge, protection from fear, you know, and from suffering. So it's either the teacher, the teachings, or also the community of people that are there when I need it, you know. So I think especially in this time, we all are refugees. The sense of connection, because all these practices are around strengthening our connection to ourselves, to who we are, fundamental wholeness, basic goodness, and also connection, of course, to others, you know, that we are feeling connected. And that's, I think, very, very important, especially now that we're on Zoom, you know, and so much virtual life, and it becomes mental, and that's kind of challenging, isn't it?
Last time, Emilia shared with us in the encounter with Dario a poem. So I thought, do I know a poem about dying?
Yeah.
It's called Child's Concept of Death. Warriors die and are born. So do swallows die and are born. In this blue sky, sun shines, moon sets. Anything could happen. May the rhododendrons never die. Juniper should not die. I will die one day, maybe without knowing. It's a poem from Chökyam Trungpa Rinpoche.
Thank you. Beautiful. Really see the dreamlikeness of life, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a profound practice of preparing for dying, actually. To be more spacious, consider everything as dreamlike.
Yes, this was the second episode of the European Buddha Podcast with guest speaker Kirsten De Leo. For more information about the show and related links, you can visit the show notes via network.europeanbuddhism.org/02. Kirsten De Leo is speaking on the upcoming EDUG online conference about death and dying on the 24th of April from 10 a.m. until 7 p.m. For more information, follow ebuconference.org. Thanks for tuning in and speaking to you soon.